You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Bring the oil and give me some gas. Speed it all up. Hit the accelerator. Accelerator.
River floods already displace more people within countries than any other cause, and they affect far more people than other disasters. New science reveals humans will have to prepare and adapt much harder for even more river flooding in the next 20 years due to climate change. Our guest is a scientist with many roles. Dr. Anders Levermann is professor of dynamics at the climate system at Potsdam University in Germany. He is a leader at the renowned Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, or PIC. He's an adjunct scientist at Columbia University in New York and lead author of the latest IPCC chapter on sea level change. He's a journal editor and more. Dr. Levermann is co-author of a new paper, Adaptation Required to Preserve Future High-End River Flood Risk at Present Levels, as published in Science Advances January 10th, 2018. Anders Levermann, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I know you're busy, so let's get right to the new paper you co-authored. Why pour so much work into studying river flooding?
Well, river flooding is actually one of the most devastating causes for damages that are caused meteorologically on the planet. And actually, meteorological damages are the strongest damages. If you ask the Munich Re, an insurance company who has the longest record for insured damages on the planet, as far as I know. So meteorological damages are important. They will most likely become more intense under global warming.
Have extreme rainfall events and floods already increased since the 1970s?
It's quite difficult if you ask for the statistics. We have been, and a lot of people still do this, which I think is important and very valid, but if we actually wait for the statistics to be done so that we can make a scientific statement that extreme events have increased in intensity or in frequency, it's generally already too late to a certain extent. I know that this, you know, this is not a very popular way to put it, because a lot of people work on the statistics of weather extremes, and then they should continue to do so. But society needs answers before they have already experienced this intensification. And that's why I very much appreciate that more and more people and more research is actually now focusing on the physical mechanisms of weather extremes. You know, that has been done for a long time, but it's done more and more. And we start to slowly understand why things become more intense. And that's why I'm giving not a very straight answer here. I realize this. But my point is that I don't really care whether they have intensified or not, because I know they will most likely become more intense under warming. And that is for very simple physical reasons. First of all, warmer temperatures, we have more evaporation on the planet. And the water that we put into the atmosphere has to get out again. There is water, obviously, in the atmosphere, and there better be. But there isn't a lot of water that the atmosphere can hold. So everything that evaporates has to fall down again. So we'll have more rainfall under global warming. In addition to that, we have a warmer water. And that's, again, Claudius Clapeyron's equation, a very simple physics. A warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor and thereby can transport more water. And you know what we find, and that is actually statistics, and that's actually what we can understand. We find that extreme rainfall events increase with the saturation value of how much water you'd actually have in the atmosphere. And that's why we have two good reasons why intense rainfall events and thereby flooding will intensify under global warming. And we've seen a degree of warming. So there has been an intensification that is not so easily found statistically, but physically there should have been.
Well, I'm certainly seeing it in the news. I know from reporting 10, 20 years ago that there just weren't that many extreme records for precipitation, whether it's rain or snow, being set, as I've had to report more recently. But that's just an experience. It's not an official scientific statistic. Before we go deeper into this, are we just talking about river flooding for people in faraway countries, or will industrialized nations in America and Europe also have to make adjustments and changes for this?
Well, we have an identification of the hydrological cycle. And what's very important in our study was that we focused only on the next 25 to 30 years. And the reason for that, generally, you know, climate scientists, and that's been included, are looking for this century, to the end of the century, because the climate change is a long-term problem, and this is where, you know, this is the century in which we have to mitigate the climate change and really change our energy system globally. But in this study, we use the fact that the next 25 to 30 years of global warming have already been caused by the emissions of the last decades up to a century. And that's a very dangerous statement to make for, you know, if you don't listen carefully, because it does not mean that it doesn't matter what we do in the next 25 or 30 years. Because what we do in the next 25 or 30 years will determine what is happening after 2040. And, you know, once 2040 arrives, we can't do anything about it anymore. We have to act now. So this was, again, a long answer. But what I'm saying is, in our study, we looked at the next 25 to 30 years. And that's why we can make an actual prediction about the intensification of river floods. And what we found is that river floods increase around the planet. But if you look at the adaptation, so also in the U.S. and also in Europe, but if you look at the need for adaptation, something interesting happens. The need of adaptation, and we defined it in such a way that we said, what do you have to do in order for the risk of floods in the next 25 years to be the same as the risk of floods that you had in the last 25 years? And what comes into play here is that different countries have different risk aversion. So in Europe, we are better protected against floods than in India or Indonesia. In the U.S., you have actually among the best protection, and you are used to this kind of protection. Now, if you want to keep this protection in the U.S., you have to do as much as we have to do in Germany in order to keep our level, and as much as people in India and Indonesia have to do to keep their level of protection. So that takes into account that different societies have set their protection level, their need or their desire for security at different levels. And since the U.S. has a very high level, you know, if you want to keep it, you have to work for it.
Now, this paper is free in full text online, and there's some great graphics with it. And in those graphics, it shows that there are new areas where people will experience floods in the 2030s that did not experience them in that period from 1971 to 2004. Where are some of those new flood areas?
Well, that is actually in a lot of regions in the United States. Since the flood here is defined as exceeding the flood protection level, you know, most of the regions in the U.S. are protected against floods. But overall, if you would do nothing, if you would not increase further protection because, for example, the administration doesn't take climate change seriously, then the U.S. overall increases the number of affected people by a factor of 9. So there will be nine times more people affected by floods in the next 25 years than there were in the last 25 years. These numbers are lower for China. You know, it's only about a doubling there. And they're tremendously high for the United Kingdom with a factor of almost 30. And Indonesia, India, and also Germany is quite high. So we really have to do something in order to stay protected.
Yes, the interesting thing in the United States is that some of the areas where projected flooding is really going to increase look to be in the Ohio River valleys, the Mississippi River valleys, in states that actually voted for President Trump, who doesn't believe in climate change. One interesting sidelight I noticed, though, that in California, there's been a lot of discussion about whether a mega flood could happen there as happened in the 1800s. And there seemed to be some disagreement amongst the climate models about the impacts of this in California. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, if you have a look at our study, it was close to call. That's what you would call it. The uncertainty in California and in large parts of the west of the United States was so big that we were not able to make a definite statement, and that shows you that there is a lot of uncertainty here. What is kind of an important lesson from our study, but from others, of course, it's not a special study in this, is that you can protect against climate change to a certain extent. You know, sea level rise can be protected against by dikes, by coastal protection. All kinds of methods are available. But if you don't protect yourself, then the impacts are really devastating. You know, that's why we get these large numbers. That's why we get, an eightfold or ninefold increase in the number of affected people. If you don't do anything, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. For example, with sea level, it's a different problem, but it's also a flooding problem. If your dike is simply too low for the sea level that you have, for the ocean height, world's ocean height, then you get tremendously, a large number of extra effects, extra impacts. And the number of affected people increases dramatically. And this is the same here with river floods. We were actually, in our study, not able to make a lot of statements about the Western U.S.
It's very distressing to see that the equatorial area of Africa will face even greater river flooding because places like the Congo are already poor and poorly governed, if not at war. What changes are coming for that region, or for Africa, let's say, in the coming climate deluges?
Africa is complicated, with respect to rain. We found, for example, that there was in a different study, but we found in 7 of the 21 climate models that did these simulations for the UN climate report, in 7 of these models, a monsoon system actually developed in the southern Sahel zone, which is at the moment a desert or close to a desert, so there's very, very little rain. And if you look at the countries, these include countries like Mali, which have civil wars at the moment, which are in unrest, and it's a terrible situation in a lot of these countries. And you would think that monsoon rainfall, that is a seasonal, regular seasonal rainfall, would be a good thing for the region. And I'm actually sure it would. But having said that, and any changes that are sudden pose a problem, at least in the beginning. That is something that you can't, I'm not saying from a climate science perspective, but, having thought that, working on societal problems too, if you think of it, if you have a sudden change in the climate, that is generally a problem because it is inducing changes in society. We'll see a lot of fluctuations in Africa, and studies have found that whenever there are climate fluctuations, you have a higher chance of societal response or unrest.
And about one-third of Pakistan went underwater in 2010 due to river flooding. What happens in Asia in the 2030s, according to your new science?
Well, Pakistan was flooded in 2010 and again in 2011. This was a special event. These were two special events which were caused by what, in the U.S. is they often called polar vortex. It was caused by a meandering of the jet stream, which led to a blockage situation, which led to a 4 to 6 weeks long hot period over Russia, including Moscow, and a lot of peatland burning there or smoldering. And at the same time, a low-pressure system in Pakistan, which created the largest freshwater lake on the planet, and was a disaster. And the next year, it happened again. These kind of events are, if anything, underestimated in our climate model. Because our climate models, they're averaging out the weather in general. That's not you know, they're not weather prediction models. So we tend to underestimate these extreme events, and we've tried to correct for this a little bit in our study, but there is, you know, a general conviction that the problem will be worse than is predicted by the climate models, and this is also the feeling, as you mentioned earlier, the feeling that a lot of people have. So if we already have a problem, see a problem in our models, then there probably is a problem. Specifically for Asia, we have the strongest signal in India, which is close to Pakistan, has more people, and Indonesia, which sees a 26-fold increase in affected people if nothing is done. And for these poor people, for these poor countries, it is actually a challenge to protect their population.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Anders Levermann from Potsdam, Germany. We're talking about humans, how they all over the world will have to prepare for coming floods as the climate shifts. I found this paper very conservative in its underlying assumptions, and probably for science that's the way it has to be. I mean, one of the issues is the assumptions based on population that it would be static, and yet we know we're adding another 83 million more humans a year. Why would you choose a static population model for this study?
Yes, that's a very important thing. So the number of affected people will increase beyond the numbers that we put in the model because, as you said, the number of people overall is increasing. We, for the main statement of the paper, which was how much do we have to increase the protection in order to stay at the same risk level in the future as we had it in the past, we only used the relative number of affected people. So that would have only been changed by a change in the density structure, in the relative density structure of the population. And since we don't have very good means to predict this at the moment, you know, people who work on this, and I trust in this research, but still, we thought that we stay, to a certain extent, we stay on the natural side of this problem and just say, well, if people don't move away, if they stay where they are, which is a reasonable assumption for the next 25 years, then this is the outcome that you'll have to protect in this way. And another reason is, by the way, that the planning for the protection, for the adaptation is done now. So a lot of municipalities will work with the data they have now.
Well, that does make sense, but people are moving. I mean, about 3 million people a week are moving into cities out of rural areas. There is a mass migration underway. Your study does look at a number of big cities that will be strongly affected by river flooding in the next couple of decades. Another question here, the expected increase in extreme precipitation events, does that figure into this study? I mean, you talk about a 1 in 100-year flood. But what if that becomes one in 30 years or even once every decade? Is it able to account for those kinds of possibilities?
So many interviews on this, and this is something that no one asked. I think that is perfect. You're a really good interviewer. Yes, well, this is actually at the core of the study. Yes, it does. That's what actually, you know, we use a climate model, which we then feed into what we call bias correct for weather extremes so that it can reproduce the past weather extremes properly so that we hope that we can have some hope that it will reproduce the future weather extremes properly. And then we feed this into river routing schemes and discharge models, which have a very high resolution. Then we look, at even a higher resolution at the flooded areas and compare this to the density of the population. So at the core, there's actually the climate model, which is accounting for these increases in frequency and intensity of floods.
Now, Anders Levermann, you led the reporting by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on Sea Level Rise. Does this study on river flooding include the growing damages from storm surges running up those rivers?
No, it doesn't. It's really separate, and there's a lot to be done there. We actually have to learn a lot about coastal flooding, too. A lot of people work on this. There's intense and important work done there, and we are not quite finished on how the sea level will actually rise. We think we can make good statements about the next few decades, but sea level rise is a long-term problem. It's something that we cause now and will go on for hundreds of years. You know, as we now remember, or some of us remember the Roman Empire, as you know, the Romans that gave us the aqueducts and certain, and the Greeks that gave us democracy. In the same way, we will be remembered in 2,000 years as the guys who started the sea level rise, which is still continuing. So sea level is a long-term problem, and we have not figured out yet how fast it'll unfold, especially beyond the next few decades. So I think for 20, 30 years, we can make a statement, but beyond that, it's difficult. To actually compute what will be flooded and what has to, you know, where protection is necessary is a very difficult problem. I know that people around the U.S. work on this, especially in San Francisco. I'm very impressed by the work of the local authorities. But yeah, it's not included here, and it'll worsen the problem.
And your study looks at what adaptation will be needed to survive in the first half of this century. But if we can't implement the emissions controls, say, by the Paris Accord, is it possible that river floods will just become totally unmanageable in the second half of this century?
Well, you can always leave behind your houses and your regions, you know. But if you think about it, that also is true for sea level rise. If we continue to emit carbon as we have done so in the past, and we continue beyond now, and we don't keep the Paris Climate Accord, then the United States will lose about 10% of its land mass eventually to sea level rise. Now, assume that another country would come and say, we take 10% of your land away. I don't think the U.S. would take this lightly, would they? And that's not the U.S. only. And no country on the planet would take it lightly if someone takes away their land. But here, we emit carbon, and we expand the oceans by the warming atmosphere, and we melt the ice on the planet. And we just, by that, give up land, our land, to the sea. Some countries will actually be affected in an existential way, in the sense that they will be just gone, the small island states in the Pacific. And other countries will just lose important coastal areas, you know, like in Florida, obviously, but the Florida Keys, you know, they will most likely not be able to protect the Florida Keys, but also New York and San Francisco get problems. They don't have to vanish, but they get problems. And the same will be with river floods. With river floods, it's more complicated because they come suddenly. There's no, slowly increasing sea level that you can see, increasing and you can protect against. They're coming subtly, so if you don't take the science as serious, and if you don't protect in accordance with the science, then it's really dangerous for the lives of the population.
As we wrap up, many of us are concerned that government-funded climate science is being dismantled and defunded in the United States and in Australia. We need to hear that Europe, China, and other countries can continue the science we need. Could you just briefly tell us, what is the Potsdam Institute and what does it work on?
Well, the Potsdam Institute is working on this, on all parts of the climate problem. We have a physical unit, if you like, and that's including me, but we also have biologists and sociologists, political scientists, economists, and try to capture the essence of it, of all the different angles of climate change. Because as you see already here, climate mitigation is a societal problem. We have to solve this without causing harm to the economy globally. Yeah? We have to switch the entire energy system of the planet to renewable energies, because as long as we emit carbon, the carbon stays in the atmosphere practically forever, and as long as we do this, we increase the temperature of the planet. So there is a societal aspect to it, and we work on this. But there's also a societal aspect to adaptation. You know, the climate impacts generally occur at one place, so you could say that adaptation is a local phenomenon. But the moment you include some kind of justice into the equation, it becomes a non-local, it becomes a global question, because the people who suffer most from it, from climate change, are not necessarily the ones that cause the problem. And in the future, we will have to really harvest the entire creativity and innovative power of the planet in order to face this problem in adaptation. And for this, we need a global scheme and a global incentive scheme, which is complicated, I guess, and we'll have to make it robust. And these are the problems that we work on in Potsdam.
Professor Anders Levermann is from Potsdam University in Germany and the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. He also works with Columbia University in New York. We've been discussing an important new paper published in the journal Science Advances. The title is Adaptation Required to Preserve Future High-End River Flood Risk at Present Levels. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published every Wednesday. Anders, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
No, it was great. You're very, very informed. I'm very impressed. And thanks a lot, you know, for getting so deep into our study. I mean it. It's really great. And thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. Most news reports about climate change warn about the frightening impact on humans. But what will happen to the animals and the plants? How does nature respond to sudden climate shifts? Our guest is Dr. Anthony Barnosky from the University of California, Berkeley. He is a paleoecologist, a longtime field researcher, and a curator of a museum of fossil mammal collections. His book is Heatstroke, Nature in an Age of Global Warming. You talk about how evolution may not be able to keep up with the changes that are coming so quickly. What is happening with evolution as far as climate change goes?
And it turns out those mutation rates are typically pretty slow when you compare them against the pace of the kind of climatic change we're seeing now. So yes, climatic change can put a selection pressure on a species to change and adapt, but really there's a speed limit that evolution can operate, and climate change is exceeding that speed limit. It turns out that really the kinds of species that have a chance of adapting and that will probably do quite well are the kinds of species that have really short generation times and produce many, 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 many individuals with each reproduction event. So what kind of species are those? Well, they're flies, mosquitoes, rats, the kinds of things we typically don't care for as humans, and the kinds of things we do like, you know, the lions and tigers and bears have very long generation times, very small numbers of offspring, so they don't have a chance to catch up evolutionarily.
Does that project as far as species extinction goes? What are scientists predicting the range there might be from climate change?
The basic answer to that is we're committed to some significant amount of climate change, even under the best case scenarios. By the 2050s, right in that ballpark, Earth is going to be hotter than it's been since humans evolved as a species, and that doesn't matter which of the scenarios you use. I think there are going to be some effects on species as far as certainly where species can live on Earth, and I think it will accelerate the rate of extinction of some of these endangered species that we're trying to protect, so that we have to take that into account and maybe change our strategies a bit on how we're trying to protect them.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.